They were having the first of the
talks of the black hole astrophysics program. Next week we will not have a talk because there's the Gamma Ray Bursts conference. So, but in 2 weeks we'll have the second of the black hole talk. And today we're pleased to have one of the organizers, Jean-Pierre Lasota, who will tell us about the fun with cataclysmic
variables, binary. Or binaries, or variables, yes. So I have several explanations for the subject of my talk, because cataclysmic binaries are binaries which contain two stars. There's no black hole in them. But the main reason was that I thought that if I want Franz Cordova to come to my talk, this title will simply make it come, and I was right. So that's true. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's exactly. So I knew you would appreciate. The other reason is that they are really fun, but there's also a intimate, so say, relation between cataclysmic binaries and systems we are supposed to study in our program, which I mean the black holes in binaries. So I decided to give a blackboard seminar because, you know, the boss said it might be a blackboard seminar, and I understand that blackboard doesn't mean the same thing in quantum gravity and in astrophysics. So serious as that. So this is a cataclysmic binary. It's a binary because there are two stars. It's a binary system. And I will say something about the binary itself. This is a very strange looking star, but it's a star. It looks like that. And gravity people should understand why it looks like that. This is something that is called an accretion disk. What is here is the central object, which in this case is a white dwarf. But if you put here a white dwarf, a neutron star or a black hole, many things that I will talk about would apply to this system. There is also a stream of matter leaving this star, and there is this zone of interaction between the stream and the accretion disk, and the accretion disk, which is called hotspot or bright spot. And it's also an important part of the system, but I won't tell you much about this. So the nomenclature is this star is called the secondary and this star is called the primary. This is just a question of nomenclature, and this got a mass M2 and this got mass M1. Now, cataclysmic variables are stars in which you have here a white dwarf and here you have a low mass star. Usually it's a star which is on the main sequence. It means it is burning hydrogen. It is in the first stage of its evolution, and the masses, for a reason that I will explain maybe in a moment, these masses are low, they are less than one solar mass. And the white dwarf is a white dwarf, which is not absolutely correct, because there is a particularity about such binary systems that single white dwarfs cannot have masses lower than half solar mass, because you cannot form them in non-binary systems. But in binary systems, you can form very light white dwarfs which masses that are, let's say, 0.4 or even less in solar masses. But this is another question. This is how you get such binaries. I'm not going to talk about it. So let's focus on this. Let me see. This is what I wanted to say. Yes, it is what I wanted to say. So there is one class of object that is important for gravity, in which this star is not only main sequence, but is also sort of a white dwarf. These are very short period systems. They are called LS-Canvan, Canvan meaning... AM-Canvan, LS-Canvan something... Thank you, Andrew. This is Andrew King, who is going to correct me. And of course, France too. France wrote one or two very good reviews on cataclysmic variables that are still a fundamental reference. So I'm safe here. If I say something silly, they will correct me. So AM-Canvan, Canvan meaning Canum Venaticorum, which means the hunting dogs. These systems are named after prototypes, they're named after quite often, and they are named after constellations, so it's more poetic than they say, I'm sorry, deep brain, you know, it's a say. Hunting dogs is much better. It's just, but simply, you know, astronomy is a very old subject, not like the brand new deep brain or M theory. So I think you will get to. In particle physics, I think charm is not so bad too. It's okay. So they are other systems which are much tighter orbits. I didn't give you the numbers here, but we'll give them in a moment. But they are a big problem, or they could be a big problem for LISA. Because these systems, as you will see in a moment, but you should guess it now, they emit gravitational waves. And the frequency and the amplitude of these waves emitted by this very short helium, they are pure helium. They could be pure helium. This is helium, and this also could be helium in such systems. They are going to be a problem for the, when you have the 10 minus 4 and you have the LISA or something like that, and this is 10 to the minus 3, they sit somewhere here. So they could be a problem for the low frequency part. And maybe some massive black holes won't be detected by them. But most of these guys I'm talking about are, they're okay. They are certainly okay because we know all their periods, so you can subtract them from the data. Okay, so we should ask the question why this star looks like that. Because this is the basis of everything. It looks like that and it loses matter. So this, we call this the secondary, we said it's a Roche lobe. Do I have to explain what a Roche lobe is? Probably, yes, I know, yeah. Okay, so if you treat, this is it is 19th century physics or something that Jim knows very well.
By the end of your talk, you will have insulted everyone.
that's why I'm invited to so many seminars. You know, people like to be insulted this way. So if you have 2-point bodies in an orbit, Keplerian orbit, if you draw the potential, the total potential, which consists of the two potential of the point sources and the centrifugal part of it, you can draw the equipotentials, and so you have 2-point sources, and this is spherical near the sources, and then if you go to bigger distances, let's say this star is more massive, so you will get a critical surface, which is called the Roche lobe. This is the Roche lobe after you have open and you have this point is called the L1 point, it is Lagrange 1 point, and there, of course there are other points, Lagrange 2 and 3, etc. This is all classical mechanics. And if a star has a radius which is comparable to the radius of its Roche lobe, then we say it's its Roche lobe. How a star can fill its Roche lobe? It can expand, and then at some moment it will fill its Roche lobe. The problem is that this is not the answer here, because as I said, these stars are on the main sequence. They burn hydrogen like Sun, and we know that Sun doesn't expand much for the moment. So, let's say for the moment that they were created like that. They fill the Roche lobe, and what's going to happen? They fill the Roche lobe, so that means that they cannot be bigger than the critical surface.
In the binary system.
Sorry?
They were created in the binary.
Let's say that, yeah. They, binaries were, we don't really know how binary was created. But it evolves to such a state through a process that I don't want to describe, because first of all, we don't really know, and it's very complicated, it's not part of this stuff. But let's assume for the moment that we create, or that God created a binary like that, it's Phyllis Roche-Loeb. And let's try to understand what is happening. Annette? As I said, this is a binary in which this is lighter. So you it must transfer mass because it is just above this critical surface, and here the gravity is equal to zero. So anything that it sticks out of the surface will do this and fall on the primary. This means that it's easy to understand that the center of mass, which say was here, will move towards the primary. By conservation of angular momentum, because I assume for the moment that I conserve angular momentum, the binary will expand. Now, the size of this Roche-Loeb is proportional, so to say, to the roughly proportional to the size of the binary, so it will expand, and the Roche-Loeb will be bigger than the star. But this is not the end of the story. This is the reaction of the system. But now, what the star is going to do? Because for the moment, I considered what the binary does when you have exchange of mass. But now we have to consider what the star is going to do. This is a bit more complicated. It depends what kind of star you have here, and also it depends on the time scale. So, if, for example, it is a star with a convective envelope. And for example, it's not really, for example, most of this, all the stars have convective envelopes. Some of them, at short periods, are totally convective. At first, it will realize that it lost mass, and gravity change, it will expand. But this is wrong, because this is on the main sequence. It is burning hydrogen. So here, you need to have a temperature, which is the temperature at which you can burn hydrogen. In this case, it is the PP cycle and a bit of CN. Oh, but this is the... So, this reaction are very sensitive to the temperature. Which means that, and the temperature in the center is proportional to M over R, the virial temperature. Now, removing the mass means lowering the temperature. And it means lowering the rate of... It's a bit simplifying, but I think the main idea is you reduce the temperature, you reduce the rate of nuclear reaction. So the star doesn't like it because it wants to stay on the main sequence, so it will contract in the end. And in fact, since we know that the sun is on the main sequence, we know that this temperature of say PP is satisfied for the star. So you can get this way, if you say that on the main sequence stars must have this temperature to burn hydrogen, you have immediately a so-called mass radius relation for main sequence. Which is this. This is a very, very simple mass radius relation, but only for main sequence. I mean, in practice, you have little constants here close to one, and it depends also if you have stars on the lower main sequence, meaning low massive star or massive star. But as a first approximation, it's a quite good rule, and also it shows that a main sequence star, when it loses mass, it shrinks. So you see a paradox here, because we exchange mass, and not only the lobe expands, but also the star shrinks. So they shouldn't exist. They shouldn't transfer mass, but they do. We see them. And of course, they do that because I assume that angular momentum is constant, but it's not. One source is well known of angular momentum loss in such systems. It is gravitational radiation. The real excuse to talk about it in this seminar, because these are relativistic objects, in fact. They emit gravitational radiation. In fact, a subclass of them evolved because of gravitational radiation emission. So they are relativistic objects in this sense. I didn't mention what the orbital periods are. These are very close systems. The orbital periods in this non-helium, they vary between 80 minutes and, say, 10 hours.
Is gravitational radiation really the dominant effect?
Yes, for a system, a short period system is absolutely dominant, and even it determines the, you will see the basic property of the system.
So even before the binary pulsar was
observed? I will mention that there was even a proposal by Paczynski to... Yes. This was, I think the first proposal was Kraft, 54? Yeah. 54, yeah. Yeah, there were, but the idea that they evolved under this was, this is 54, yes. And the fact that that one of the puzzling properties of this, of the class of systems, is determined by gravitational radiation is 1980 by Paczynski, and I will mention it in a moment.
So roughly, what is the separation?
The separation? Yeah, the masses are less than one solar mass, and this of course can be, the white dwarf can be up to the Chandrasekhar mass. The separations for these periods applying the Kepler law, which applies to the systems, of course, gives you separation between, say, 10 to the 11 and 10 to the 10 centimeters. So the short period system, you could put them into the sun. The whole binary would fit into the sun. So they are. Sorry?
How would that be in terms of mass or
Schwarzschild radii? Oh, Schwarzschild radii. Schwarzschild radii. I would say it is 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. Yeah, 10 to the 5 to the 4. Yeah, 10 to the 5 to the 4, yes. Yes, I have a nice formula for you in a moment. Containing both the Bohr radius and the Schwarzschild. And the Schwarzschild radius of the proton. So, where are we? Okay. So they emit gravitational radiation. You can calculate it, and it's something that can be probably for the shortest period system. This guy that are here at 80 minutes could be detected by LISA. But in a sense, it's boring because we know that they should emit gravitational radiation. So, as I told Peter Bender, it would be better that if LISA see nothing coming from this binder. This would be a big discovery, scientific discovery. If it sees that they emit what is you know, predicted, then it's not worth spending all this billions or whatever. The hope is in the massive binary black holes, of course. So I will come in a moment to this amazing fact that there are no hydrogen cataclysmic variables below this period. Okay, give it plus minus 5 minutes. If you plot a histogram in which here you have the number of observed cataclysmic variables, and you have the orbital period, let's say an hour. So if here is 80 minutes, here is say 2 hours, here is 3 hours, and here is whatever. You see almost a wall here, and not almost a wall. In the distribution, then you know they have something. There's a very interesting feature here, and something like that. Oops. Looks like that. Now, this is also very important. I won't have time to talk about this, which is.
Look at the back of the N.
Sorry?
What is N like?
The total N is now 300? 350.
So these things are very common.
Oh yes. That's why they are such fun. You know, you don't have to wait for them to do things.
They
are plenty.
All within our galaxy.
The one we study are all in our galaxy, but you see them in Magellanic clouds, and there is no reason for them not to exist in other galaxies.
But if they're spiraling in, they must exist at shorter and shorter periods until they merge.
So no. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. They don't do it. An explanation, and this is due to Einstein, Albert Einstein. So, I don't know. In such a bin here is what 20. It depends on the binning, of course. But you know, the statistic is absolutely clear. There is, you know, there were people claiming that this doesn't exist, that the selection effect this and that. It does exist, and in fact, with my friend Andrew, we spent several years of our life to explain this or to test this hypothesis, and I don't have time to talk about it today, but this is certainly here. And as you said, I mean, why should be a minimum period? You you expect the star to merge, and so it should go to zero periods. Not so. Just to reassure people who came here and think, you know, and like quantum gravity, during Abhay's talk there was a question, because it was a very nice quote from Einstein who said that we should include gravitational radiation in an atom that we quantize gravity because an atom would emit gravitational radiation. And so, just for you, I calculated a formula for gravitational radiation of a, where is it? Huh. Oh yes, the time it would take for, assuming it will collapse, because we know that for an atom to radiate all its gravitational energy by gravitational waves, I mean all this rotational energy, and this is the Bohr radius divided by the Schwarzschild radius of the proton to the power 3, multiplied just for fun by this ratio. Here you have alpha minus 1. And for some reason divided by the Compton frequency of an electron. I hope the number will be something like 10 to the power 137 or to the power. No, it's just an enormous power, 110 or something like that in seconds. If you want in years, you know what to do. Sorry. So I don't think that in this Einstein argument was right, maybe not. I don't know. I won't dare to criticize Einstein here. Okay. So this was just for comparison. In the case of CVs, you can do the same. I mean, you have all the elements. Just replace the Bohr radius by the Baryon separation. You get times for our system, which are 10 to the 9 years, and shorter than the age of the universe. So, in this part, okay, I will tell you in a moment that gravitational radiation can explain practically everything below two hours. Here we need an additional mechanism. Okay, so let's go back here, because I have to explain why they don't want to merge. They don't want to merge because these are stars and not material points. They are made of material points, or they are maybe made of debrances, I don't know. I was reassured by Murray Gell-Mann saying that the M theory won't explain everything. For example, astronomy was on his list, so I feel reassured, at least for the moment. So, as I said, the star loses mass. It is on the main sequence, so it wants to shrink, but its first reaction is to expand. And everything will depend on the characteristic timescale. Its timescale to contract is the so-called Kelvin-Helmholtz time, which is the time, well, it's also 19th century physics or astrophysics, when people calculated how long would the sun live if it had to radiate all its gravitational energy. Then they got the obvious result, which was something is missing here. R squared L2. Okay, L. I put the two. Sorry. R. Okay, that's one squared, but with this two. So this is the characteristic time scale. And for system of interest, I copied it from a nice review article by Andrew King, so if there's an error, it's his fault. I didn't check. This is 2 hours because it applies to minus.
Is L the luminosity?
L is the luminosity, sorry. I'm sorry, I assume that the notation is not, but of course, don't hesitate to interrupt me when I forget. So L is luminosity. Sorry? This is period in hours. Orbital period in hours. This is the Kelvin-Helmholtz time for a star. You take a star of this mass and this radius, and it will readjust its thermal structure in such a time. Typically, it's a characteristic time. And then you can calculate from the quadrupole formula for the well-known quadrupole formula for gravitational radiation, the mass transfer rate. The mass transfer is just mass transfer with mass loss rate from the star, which is due just to contracting of the Roche lobe. And this is, no, sorry, it's 2 10 to the 9, the same units, 5/3. You can see they are very close. They are very close, and in fact they are comparable, they are almost everywhere comparable here. The net effect is that these stars, and I think it's a unique case in the universe on such a long time scale, they are not in thermal equilibrium. They have more luminosity coming from the surface that produced by nuclear reaction in the center. They are oversized and overluminous. Because what is happening, the star wants to, when it loses mass and it first expands, wants to contract to get higher temperature. But the mass is lost. And if the mass is lost on a time scale that is comparable, or God forbid faster, than the thermal readjustment time, it is oversized. And then it's easy to check that around, what is it, roughly, if you use this very simple argument you can make, and people do, of course, around 0.5 hours. Okay, you can take the ratio of the two, and you see that the power in period is 25 over 6 or something like that, so it's a very high period power. You arrive at a moment, I'm not going to say in a moment in time, but in a moment, where this, instead of contracting, the star will start expanding. It will be helped, and this is, I'm not sure it's a coincidence or not, it also becomes degenerate. It's no longer the main sequence, it is degenerate, its mass is very small because it loses mass. Yeah, it is closely related in mass, but...
Because you get an isentropic configuration.
Yeah, so the yeah. Mm. Yeah, so the two things make that the if you plot now the period of the star as a function of what? I want to make this. So this is period and this is time. Period or mass. Oh, yeah, mass. Yes, yes. So this is the main sequence, this is the degenerate sequence. This is a diagram produced by Paczynski in 1980. The star, of course, is, as I said, is not on the main sequence because it's losing mass, it's out of thermal equilibrium, and it's going more and more, so it's going through these stages. Here is around 80 minutes. And has to expand back. Now, when Paczynski got it was 1980, it was before the binary pulsar, not discovery, but at least...
But the binary pulsar was discovered around 73
or something. Yeah, but I don't see the data where... Yeah, the date, yeah.
Like 1980.
Yeah. At that time, he proposed this as an independent test of general relativity. Because you can show that... I will comment on that this, the value of this period, I mean, he thought then, everybody thought was very exciting, depends only on the Einstein's theory of relativity. You take the quadrupole formula, you put it in the equation, and you get 80 minutes. So, it was said that this is an independent test of Einstein theory and the quadrupole formula. But reality, as it happens always in astrophysics, or quite often in astrophysics, is more complicated. Because I said, and I hope you more or less understood, that this part here is determined by the how much the star is out of thermal equilibrium. Or how big is what we call the luminosity deficit, the difference between between the luminosity at the surface and the center. But this, the luminosity at the surface, depends on the opacities. on atomic physics and the power of how much grains there is, about how much dust there is there. And in fact, you can show that putting a bit, you know, of dirt into the atmosphere of a star, you can move it up and down, and the fact that 80 minutes, that you obtain 80 minutes or 78 minutes, is not really an independent proof of or test of general relativity.
I think, in all honesty, we ought to admit that the terrestrial bodies don't agree with 80 minutes.
Yeah, that's the best story. Yeah, this is true. And also, the best observed is 75 minutes.
That's why that period is 80 minutes.
Yeah, well, just 80 minutes, that is true. And in fact, this was before we understood this difficulty, and Jean-Marie Amery, who was here on the program, he then proposed to determine the amount of dust of grains in atmosphere by using general relativity. Which I think would, for it didn't work still, but the idea was nice.
How do you know it didn't work?
No, because we have now more observation than in the 80s, and we see that there is another problem here with this.
Do you have an independent measurement of the amount of dust?
No, we don't. That's precisely the problem. That's why it would be nice to use Einstein's theory. Because then if we really have we have a very nice theory, and if we produce 80 minutes corresponds to observation, we know that it corresponds to no more than, I don't know, 5% of dust in the atmosphere. This was the idea.
When you drew the data, you showed a very, very sharp cutoff. I should take it literally that there's a sharp cutoff.
It is, I think.
Does the theoretical explanation explain the sharp cutoff? Because they want these corrections fast, and so you would expect to be rounded out.
No, the problem, in fact, is the. I don't remember how many systems are here in the last bin, but 30, 40. No more.
A couple of minutes,
yeah. But the problem is that what theory, and we know very well, which Andrew predicts, is not something like that, but predicts something like that. The problem is that these systems, since a minimum period, they have to spend a lot of time there, and they are bright enough to be seen. So in fact, the cutoff is very well explained, but the distribution to the longer periods is not well explained.
So is the secondary going to be completely disrupted at the end of this?
It's not going to be disrupted. I think it's okay. It's not clear what's going to happen to it. The system will going to expand. This will probably become if nothing happened to the system, it's not clear what will happen to the system, become a planet or a... It's not going to be a brown dwarf, because a brown dwarf is something that never burn hydrogen, but it's going to be some boring planet. Maybe with some civilization that will be less boring, but I don't believe that.
Theoretically, they reach the size of Jupiter and then the mass radiation turns over.
Yeah,
they
become planet. Yeah, then it's sort of a...
Several Hubble times.
Yeah.
So all this time just crawling away from it.
Just becoming a white dwarf planet system. We even tried with Andrew to find some, but it's very difficult. Very difficult because the white dwarf doesn't move. You can't find the orbital period because the mass ratio, I mean, the mass of this mass is so small that the motion of the white dwarf is too tiny. So this is application of relativity to calculating variables. It's not perfect, but probably our description of what is happening, not to the gravitational radiation, of course, but to the systems near this period is too crude, and we don't take into account several effects, and in fact we have some idea. Sorry, she was first.
So is mass and angular momentum loss negligible in all these systems that we're talking about here?
I think mass is negligible, angular momentum loss is absolutely crucial.
No, I mean just loss from the system.
Yes,
in other forms than gravitation.
In other forms than gravitation. This is a good question.
Particle.
I mean, there are some winds, but okay, I don't.
Magnetic braking.
Wait a minute. I mean, you know too much for this seminar.
No.
I will wait a minute. Okay, I will go to. If you want magnetic braking, okay, magnetic braking. But Gary wanted to ask a question.
So I was just getting a little confused because you're talking about this mass transfer causing the system to expand, but the gravitational radiation usually causes things to, you know, spin out.
Yeah. Okay. But yes. But here. Okay. You're right as long as the gravitational radiation dominates. But now, the reaction of the star changes. I said that before it contracts. Now it is it reacts by expanding to the mass loss. So, and this effect dominates. In fact,
the simple way of saying it is that the system has a lower angular momentum in a slightly wider orbit, but with a lower mass balance.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it loses sufficient mass because of the GR. But it actually puts this lower mass object slightly further out.
So the net result is an expansion, which is also true of all this helium, much shorter period.
It's because they expand on mass loss, they lose more mass than we would have expected, which changes the orbit
length, makes
it finally even conserving angular momentum wider than you would have thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same.
That would increase the period.
It does. So it loses. Because you rearrange the mass in the system in the way that it goes this way. Now, first, Bob asked about magnetic braking. I mean, here the notation was with two, because if you try to describe properties of systems here with only gravitational radiation, doesn't work. The mass transfer rates are much too low to explain the observed properties, and of course we have to now invent or to take into account other mechanisms of angular momentum loss. And of course the final thing that you realize then that Einstein's theory is very simple, because what you have to put to explain the longer period system is very complicated, and we call it magnetic braking. Probably it is magnetic braking. You can see that our sun, its rotation slows down because of emission of a magnetized wind, which takes away angular momentum. And there is no reason why this shouldn't happen in these systems. Now, of course, you would say, what's the relation between loss of spin and angular momentum from the orbit? But these systems are synchronous in the orbit. They are locked in the orbit by the tidal forces. So there's a coupling between the rotation of the star and the orbital motion. So there's a way, but this is not unique. You have to take into account various models, more or less ad hoc. It's no longer a general relativity.
What's a magnetized wind? How does it carry magnetic?
Okay. In fact, you know, when you listen to radio and you have disturbance, so this is one of the results of the emission of magnetic field. You have a rotating star, okay, with some magnetic field going out. This is very schematic, and you have a wind. Now the wind, it is thought and it is reasonable. The wind is coupled to the magnetic field close to the star, so it rotates with the star and it takes, and then at some so-called alpha radius, it is no longer tied to the field line, and escapes, and takes the angular momentum of this lever arm. So I call magnetized wind. I mean, I say by the interaction of a wind, which can be magnetized too. That's another story. With a interaction of the wind with a magnetic field of a rotating object, and this is. This has been observed with the sun, and I think 1962, every Schatzman was the first to propose it. It's the mechanism of breaking rotation of the sun. Of course, you cannot just apply what you know about the sun to these systems. Some people have objections. They say they fail the Roche law, so their properties will be different. And of course, as usual, when you don't have a real theory, some people say there will be less activity, so there will be less magnetic field. Some people say the opposite, there will be more activity. In fact, they are rapidly rotating stars, as you know, because these are short periods. And we know that isolated magnetized star, I mean, isolated, rapidly rotating star have a lot of magnetic activity, winds, and so it looks reasonable, and we need to explain that anyway, and nothing else comes to mind. But I think it will take some time before we get a theory of that, if ever. How much time am I left with? 15 minutes, okay. So I have 15 minutes, I will see, because I had something for 2 or 3 hours, you know, but as usual, as it happens with your favorite subject. Okay. Now you say, what about systems with, if I put a black hole here, a neutron star, what's the story going to be? In principle, the story should be similar. I didn't mention, you know, the masses are different, so the numbers could be different. But in principle, should be the same. If I replace the white dwarf with a black hole or a neutron star.
What if you replace it with another
main sequence star? Then of course I have to increase the, because I have to fit here to this Roche of a main sequence star, and I get much larger. Yeah, there are so-called symbiotic stars, for example, that some of them could be like that. But if I have to increase the periods, and I don't have, for example, the relativistic effects are negligible. So I don't expect this such system to have the same evolution. And of course, if I have a main sequence star, it is still evolving. This guy here is dead, so I don't have to take it into account. I mean, except for once it happens to it, it accretes matter. Of course, matter accumulates here, and after, say, 10,000 to 100,000 years, it blows up as a nova. Nova is a thermonuclear explosion at the surface of a white dwarf. So these systems also, from time to time, are novae. Which is not my favorite subject, I must say. It's very important, but I found one CB meeting I created in a very famous club called BBN, which was the board by Novi. And we had one of the best specialists joining us, so it says something. Okay, But what's going to happen if I put here a neutron star, a black hole? From the point of view of the evolution, this is a point mass. It doesn't do anything. All the action is here. And if you look at the period distribution of this system, it doesn't look like that at all. There are less systems, I must say, less non-orbital period. It looks something like. Maybe there is somewhere here. There are less systems, but it doesn't seem to. We saw that there are no systems below 4 hours some years ago, but now they found below 2. I don't know if there's not enough data or if the story is different. It could be different. There are many arguments for it to be different. We even wrote with Andrew several papers. Half of them were not true. Not correct, so to say. The idea was very good, but somehow nature didn't choose them. So the evolution of these systems somehow doesn't fit this very simple scenario. And the scenario is more than a scenario; it's a model, it's a theory. And also there are problems with magnetic braking. Doesn't seem to give the right answers, but this is an open question. I think Andrew wants to challenge this point of view.
I suspect the biggest difference between these low mass X-ray environments, the ones with black holes and neutron stars, and the CVs you've been talking about, is the initial state of the body when it's first created, before it comes into contact.
Yeah.
And that probably black holes and neutron star systems have more massive components than the start mass transfer.
In the last Tuesday of this month, he's going to talk about it if everybody's interested. Last Tuesday of March, Andrew King about evolution of black hole binary systems. So I'm not going to enter into details. In the last 5 minutes, I will tell you why I'm really interested now in these systems.
Optical.
They're observed in almost everything. They're observed mainly optical, is how they were discovered, of course. They're observed in UV, in EUV, in X-rays, of course, because Franz Cordova, she is the best specialist. In radio, yeah. Yes. That's precisely why I'm interested in them, because at least now I'm interested in this part of the object, white dwarf, or frankly neutron star or black hole, and this stuff here, which is the accretion disk or accretion flow. And X-rays in the white dwarf system, they must come from here. It is where the potential well is the deepest, and if you look at the temperature, you can get if the gas is optically thick, so the effective temperature is too low to produce X-rays. But if you have an optically thin, you can see the virial temperature, so to say, in photons, then you get few times keV photons. In fact, there is a very nice category of this system in which there's no accretion disk, because there's a magnetic field so strong that it disrupts the magnetic field. There's no magnetic field at all, and they are like X-ray pulsar, but in a white dwarf version. They accrete from a column that radiates X-rays, and they are pretty strong X-ray sources. They can be as bright in X-rays as the sun, or brighter. But this must come from very, very close to the surface. Most of the radiation in a disk system is produced depending on the accretion rate, on the rate in which the mass is transferred, in ultraviolet and in optical. And what is fascinating with this object, that they don't look usually like that. I mean, they never look like that, of course, almost. But if you plot the time and say the luminosity, because it's a seminar for everybody, but normally something which is called magnitude. But so you have some boring behavior, and then
P is not the period.
No, this is time. This is time. Time in years, in Julian years even. Sorry, days, not years. And then something happens here, two or three orders of magnitude increase very rapid in half a day of the luminosity, and then it goes down during a few days, a week. Then it goes, nothing happened. Sometimes, of course, it changes shape, changes amplitude. And such systems are called dwarf novae. And they have nothing to do with novae. I mean, they have something to do with novae because they are the same system, but there are no explosion of thermonuclear explosion. There's something happening in the disk. And if something is happening in the disk, it's a disk instability. And you see some very similar things in systems with black holes and with neutron stars. In fact, systems of this type with black holes are all, as we call, transient. Transient in the language of X-ray astronomy means such a behavior. Or in fact, technically it means that they disappear from the X-ray sky, you see nothing. This is the limit by the instrument. Now you see something, so there's nothing, that they appear and they disappear. They have this shape more or less. And I think the big challenge is to explain this and study disk instability. And this, we have general ideas what this instability is due to. It's a very well-known physical mechanism in one part. It's a thermal instability and a viscous instability. 5 minutes, it's a great challenge to explain the thermal viscous instability. 5 minutes, but I will do it. I will understand nothing, but I will do it. So, of course, I didn't say how the accretion disk works, but matter is falling in. but but it comes from the angular momentum that is left here. So it has to lose this angular momentum in order to fall into the. So you need a viscosity. I mean, you need some friction, and we call it viscosity. And we don't know what it's due to. We have theories as models, but we don't have a real final theory. We describe it in a very primitive ways, but we don't. We think it is a turbulent viscosity. We think that we know at least of one mechanism, which is MHD instability that drives this turbulence. The problem is that this disks are quasi Keplerian, so they are stable to linear perturbation. So this is not simple. It's not simple to do theory if you don't know what the basic mechanism is. I mean, you should know how difficult it is, of course, because you are in the similar business in the micro. Weak magnetic field. You know, this is the problem of turbulence. It is, I think, you have on the one hand the two, I think, fundamental problems of the 21st century. One thing is particle physics, or, you know, fundamental theory. The other is turbulence. We still don't understand turbulence, as Feynman says, I think, in the introduction to his lecture. This is something that has been started by Leonardo 500 years ago. We still don't understand how turbulence works. We have some partial information. It looks Keplerian. We have even very good.
What exactly is
turbulent? Turbulent is okay. The flow is almost exactly Keplerian, but of course it's not totally Keplerian because there's motion here. And what is turbulent? If you see now face on this disk, I don't know even what the scale is, but turbulent, there are eddies. You know, in this direction, it's a supersonic flow. So it is sort of a turbulence in a supersonic flow with matter slowly diffusing in under the action of this viscous torque. We don't really know how to do it. Yes, yes, yes.
I just was just wondering, I mean, how do these accretions compare with those around black holes?
They're the same. Yeah, that's why I say that. The only difference is, of course, that the inner parts are deeper in the potential, well, so they have higher temperatures. Mm-hmm. But they are supposed to be run by the same mechanism, which is, of course, not clear, but. It could be, you know, I don't know, it's somebody speculated that the source of viscosity in the outer disk is different from the source of viscosity in the.
Scaling one or something, like
when
processes scale up and.
Should I tell them the truth?
Do you know what the Reynolds number or the.
Yeah, the Reynolds numbers are enormous. Enormous. That's exactly what I would say. That the if you took the molecular viscosity, the Reynolds numbers are 10 to the 17 or whatever.
10 to the 17.
Yeah, that's why if you take the turbulent, the turbulent, so to say, Reynolds number is 1, of course.
Why is that? Why is it so big?
The hard is supersonic.
Yeah, that's exactly that. They are supersonic. Yeah.
Because the systems are so big, that's really the main.
Yeah, the system is big, and they are supersonic too, because the speed too. So I can tell you the truth, because we write the. No, okay, I will do it. It's been published. It's been published a long time ago. This is the coefficient of kinematic viscosity, and we write it like that. Alpha is a parameter. It's not this alpha, of course. Speed of sound. Squared divided by the Keplerian angular velocity squared, which in fact the idea is to write it like that. H is the thickness or the semi-thickness of the disk, and this is supposed to mimic. This was invented by Bashakura and Sunyaev a long time ago. It's supposed to mimic the turbulent viscosity, in which we know that at least in the Kolmogorov regime, I think, that the coefficient of viscosity is proportional to the mean velocity of the eddies and the mean size of the eddies. So we're saying here, okay, we don't know the mean speed, but let's scale it with one parameter by the speed of sound, and then this is the most tricky part because we have a flat system, but you could have eddies much bigger. But let's say this also scales the size of the eddies. This has been used, and I must say, with a lot of success, to describe
where alpha is a number of order what?
Where alpha is less than one, and in practice, it is, let's say, between and 0.1, 0.3. Okay, one even sometimes, but. Of course, it can be early realized that alpha cannot be really a constant. Can be a constant in a given situation. And we know, for example, that to explain this type of behavior of the disk, this alpha cannot be a constant. It has to be different. It must be an alpha, we call it cold, an alpha hot here. It must be different. But it's put by hand in the model. And this is the main fundamental difficulty in dealing with black holes in astrophysics, if they accrete. If they don't, who is interested? Because we don't know how to describe the viscosity. There's been a lot of progress, but still we are not able to say that nu is a function of r theta phi. T, for example, or new function of rho and T at least. We don't have such formulae. You have to improvise and then test with observations. In fact, this was the idea, that if we can explain this, we can get, you know, into alpha, but it doesn't work so well.
But how do you explain
that? How explain that? You see, I try to avoid. It's very easy. At such a range of, okay, let's now plot, it will be the last plot after even you ask me, I got. Let's plot here the effective temperature of the disk as a function of the surface density. It's two dimensional, so we use the sigma's integrated rho, dz. And you can show that if you fix this alpha, the mass of the star, the central star, at a given radius, you can describe as an equilibrium model of an accretion disk with these two numbers. So a model at a given radius will be represented by a dot. And on this plane, they form, let's say, a logarithm, for example, whatever. This is the hot part of the solutions. They form a line which has this inclination. Now something happens here, and then something happens here. They have this typical S curve shape. Of course, we see S curve shapes, we see catastrophe and limit cycle. That's how it works, in fact. This, so just to remind you, every point here is a model. Okay, so if you want to represent the whole disk, you have to plot more such curves for each radius. But let's concentrate on this. This is happening at around 7,000 Kelvin, so it's about 6,000 Kelvin, roughly. What is happening here? The hydrogen, which was ionized here, get recombined. That's happening somewhere here, but there's an enormous change in opacities or in emissivities of the disk. And how a disk works? It works in the following way. At each radius, you have energy released by viscosity, because viscosity not only removes angular momentum, but also this friction, so this heat release. There's also, I would say that because Mitch will be pleased with that, he discovered this recently. There's also a also the viscous torque transports energy, so there's more energy release than just the gravitational energy here, but let's forget it for the moment. And in a, for the disk to be thin, this has to be radiated away. So the thermal equation is Q plus heating equal cooling. And heating will depend on what we assume about viscosity, but cooling will depend on the atomic processes radiating. And there's an enormous change in the opacities or in the emissivities. In fact, the opacities decrease in this part with temperature. Here they start to increase, and this explains this shape. And then everything gets neutral and so on, and you get a cold disk here. So this is 7,000 and 6,000. It varies a bit because it depends on the heating part. Now it is easy to see that on this part. So this is a line of thermal equilibrium. This is equilibrium. H times on this part, heating is bigger than cooling. On this, it's just the opposite. What is happening if I have a little perturbation at a point here? Up in temperature, cooling is bigger than heating, goes back. The same here and the same here. But here, it is of course unstable. You have a runaway. Now, this effective temperature is related to the accretion rate, to the rate at which matter is transferred through the disk. So you can replace, for the sake of argument, this with m dot. The shape will be a bit different, will be stretched because the relation is T4 effective goes like m dot. But and now, if you remember my first drawing, there was the secondary star putting matter disk, and the disk was getting from the secondary something it didn't ask for. Then control. Let's assume that it is here. So the disk should be forced to transform to be in this position, but this is an unstable equilibrium. So let's say this perturb goes down, but of course this is an equilibrium, is it the wrong equilibrium? The equilibrium corresponds to this accretion rate. So by diffusion it rearranges its surface density, increases surface density to get to the right mass transfer rate. But there's no more equilibrium here, so it goes in a more or less thermal time up. And once more, this is too high, so it goes down, and you have a limit cycle. And this is a thermal time, this is a viscous time. The viscous time is what is called in this system the secular time, which is much longer than the thermal time. So it explained, this is the thermal time, this is the viscous time. Here is the model, here is the explanation. Of course I cheated, because this is only one radius. This would happen if we had only one radius, and in fact what the disk must be in such a state everywhere. You see this is go up, so the disk must be everywhere in a say cold state here, then somewhere it becomes unstable, there's a heating front propagating, putting up the disk everywhere in the upper branch. This of course is non-local, so in fact you will have matter diffusing from annulus to annulus, so this line won't be really straight, and you know, it's more the global behavior is very interesting and a bit more complex than that. So in fact, this doesn't really corresponds to the thermal time, but in fact to the propagation time of the heat front. Then there is, after all the disk is in the heights in the hot state, there's a cooling front propagating, and this corresponds to that. And to obtain this, and to obtain light curves and spectra that correspond really to what is observed, we are not yet really able. I mean, I would say it's difficult to imagine that something else is working here to produce that. But we miss many details and one fundamental information, which is this. Maybe I'll stop here, unless you ask me to continue.